This is the Medicast, May 21st, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 67. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's podcast. Happy EMS week, everybody. I hope you all are doing some sort of awareness activity in your jurisdiction, something to let the public know that we're out there, how we do our jobs, and who we are. So let's make sure we get out there and do that. There's plenty of time left this week to do something, even if it's talk about what you do at the place you usually go to buy your lunch or your dinner or whatever. That's always important. We need to really do a lot to educate the public about what we do and get to know us a little bit so that they're more comfortable calling us when they really need help. And maybe if they get to know us a little bit, they'd be a little less likely to call us if they're just having a minor ache or something that might not necessarily need 911. So this is why EMS Week is important, and it's a good time for us all to get on the same page with those kind of things. Speaking of getting on the same page, let's jump right on into this week's listener email. My first listener email comes in from a long-term listener, Gustavo, who's a paramedic who originally hails from Puerto Rico, but is currently in medical school, and he wanted to comment on my recent talk about using ammonia inhalants. And he said, you know, when he heard that I was talking about ammonia inhalants in that episode, he was all ready to shoot me an email and blast me for supporting the use of ammonia inhalants, until he found out that I was dead set against using ammonia inhalants. So, Gustavo, thanks for the email, and good luck with completing your school and getting on down the road there. I can only imagine how difficult medical school must be, but I also know that you're a paramedic and you've got what it takes to move on into that field as well. So continue listening to the show, and please, please continue sending your comments, your corrections, and everything else in here to the show as well. It's greatly appreciated. My next email comes in from listener Daniel, and Daniel had commented on a situation that he was involved with recently where he went to pick up a student who was a female student who was involved in some kind of a sexual assault. And he was concerned because she didn't want an ambulance or any kind of trip to the emergency room, but she was convinced by people at the scene to go into the local hospital's emergency department for some evaluation. And she ended up being transported in a squad car with a single male officer. And Daniel was wondering if there was anything he could have done to try to figure out a better way to handle this. Was it inappropriate for her to be transported alone with a male? And we touched on this briefly at the Medicast Live episode that a lot of you have picked up from the feed, where we talked with Dr. Fran Babis about this. And she was really unable to help out a whole lot because it's just not something she deals a lot with as far as rape trauma victims. But I went ahead and thought some more about it. And I have some comments, Daniel, and I don't know if they'll help. And I guess my answer here is that this is one of those situations where you need to kind of play it by ear and you need to be an advocate for your patient. And that's one of those things that we talk about a lot, but we don't really know what it means. Being an advocate for your patient is being the person who is going to step up and point out that there might be a difficulty with something that's going on. Being an advocate for your patient is noticing that they live in deplorable home conditions and making sure you report that off to the nurse, or even going the next step and calling social services to just say, hey, maybe someone needs to check in on this elderly person. Maybe there's a better facility or a way that they can get some assistance in their home. All of these things involve being an advocate for your patient, really stepping outside the strict boundaries of medical care and giving medications and taking blood pressures and doing all those things that we do, and taking it to the next step and really getting out there and telling the people that we're going to be the person that's going to get their back, that's going to watch out for them until they get handed off to the next care provider. And so in this situation, I think maybe, and I'm not going to second guess you here, Daniel, because I really think that, you know, there's no right answer to this. This is just kind of something you have to feel your way through. But maybe get an opportunity to get the officer alone and point out this to that person. Maybe it's not something he had thought of. The other problem is that unless you have another female there on the scene, either another female EMS provider or another female police officer, then what do you end up doing? Is it okay for you to transport, or is it any better for you to transport this person alone in the back of the ambulance with you? So it's kind of a gray area, but maybe when you and this police officer kind of put your heads together and figure out a way, maybe is there a friend that can ride along with her? Is there another female at the scene that can ride along with her and with the police officer, if the police officer can give them a ride right back to the scene of the incident? Again, this is all something you're going to have to play by ear and kind of see what's going on. Maybe there's another provider nearby or another unit nearby, either ambulance or police unit, that could come and make the transport, because this is something that I know police officers get training about as well. Maybe there's no one else out there to handle this, but at least you can discuss it amongst yourselves. And Dr. Fran brought up something a lot when she was talking about dealing with anybody that's having some kind of an emotional problem, whether it's a long-term psychiatric issue or something that's short-term like a traumatic incident such as a rape. And she talked about involving the patient in the discussion, even if it's just validating their feelings. So you can ask her, hey, we're going to get you to the hospital. You wanted to go get checked out, and I think that's a really great thing. Are you going to be okay being transported in the police car? Do you feel safe and comfortable with this person? And you know, it's okay to ask that question. Okay, you know, we got thick skin. The police officer has thick skin. We're not going to be offended if she says, no, I'm really not very comfortable about it. You know, but maybe you can say something, or just the fact that you've mentioned it will allow her to voice those feelings of concerns. You validate them. You can say, oh, well, I can certainly understand that you might be, and that's why I asked the question. We just wanted to see. We don't think we have an alternative, but we wanted to find out if there's anything we could do that would make you more comfortable. Could we put music on? Could we, you know, these are all things you can think about in on the road. So I just wanted to address this and really take it to the next step, that this is a gray area. There's not going to be a right or wrong answer. There's going to be a different answer nearly every time this crops up for any of us. And hopefully it doesn't crop up often, but Daniel raises a good point. And I wanted to just kind of throw it out there that this is one of those situations where you're going to have to think outside the box. It's not in our protocols other than to be sensitive. And it's something that we really need to be proactive about. We can be advocates for our patients. We can talk with other providers and other professionals on the scene, and we can talk with the patient and validate their feelings, let them know that we understand their feelings, and ask them what we can do to make them more comfortable. So I'm going to let it go at that. It's a little bit of a long-winded answer, but I wanted to kind of bring it up because I don't think we really got the question answered during the MedicCast Live episode with Dr. Fran, although there was a ton of great information in there. So if you haven't listened to that episode from this past Tuesday night, please go ahead and do so. Okay, let's jump right on into this week's news, shall we? Well, I'm going to be covering pediatric airway a little bit later in a special interview, but I thought I would jump in here with some more information on pediatric patients. And part of EMS Week is, of course, EMS for Children, the focus on making sure we're good providers for patients that are young and not like adults physiologically. And one of the things that we tragically run into all too often is traumatic brain injury in children, and often traumatic brain injury caused by abuse such as shaken baby syndrome. I found an interesting study that deals with pediatricians and pathologists, and the fact that the study found that they see traumatic brain injury quite differently. In fact, they see traumatic brain injury and are unable to agree in many cases on the causes of traumatic brain injury. Was it intentional? Was it based on abuse? And so this study really highlights the need for improved uniform definitions for research and for finding more information about traumatic brain injury and its causes in children so that we can better identify cases of child abuse and neglect. The study came out in the April issue of the Journal of Child Abuse and Neglect, and what it basically said was that in the study, pediatricians and pathologists were able to agree in the cases that involved confessions, traumatic birth history, or a witness to abuse or accident, but they were unable to agree on 50% of the hypothetical cases. The cases were presented in realistic conditions where there was incomplete or missing information on the case that they were reviewing, and they had to make a decision based on the findings that they came across. And so what this study does is it will help them to develop a uniform definition that can be used to find unintentional or purposefully inflicted pediatric traumatic brain injury. And one of the things that I think this brings up to me when I think about it is the importance of when we deal with pediatric patients that may have a traumatic brain injury or any injury that we even in the slightest hint suspect is abuse, we need to be really careful about conveying that information completely to the staff at the ER. We need to be able to say to them, you know, look, something strange was going on. I'm not sure what, but I couldn't get a straight answer from the mother, and I got multiple stories from the father, and I'm really not sure what really happened in this situation. You can also talk about conditions in the home. You can talk about other things you've seen in the area and really try to relay your concerns so that they can better be able to make a diagnosis of what's going on and be better able to document on their end what they see going on in the ER and be able to move forward to contact social services, police agencies, whoever needs to be contacted to if it is a case of abuse and not an accident. So just something to think about, and hopefully we can have some better information on this on our end in the future so that we can help maybe with the direction of these uniform development guidelines that they're trying to come up with for these studies. Maybe we can help lend some information or at least have their uniform definitions in our pockets as well so we can be on the same page. Moving right along, I found another study that has to do with women and heart attacks. And we've talked about this topic before, how women and some minority groups and people with certain disease processes are unable to recognize heart attacks during the event. And we really need to use a high index of suspicion when other symptoms are present, not just chest pain. However, the study I found actually said that many women, especially women under the age of 55, do not recognize heart disease symptoms as heart disease. They don't think they're old enough to have those kind of symptoms. Researchers from the Yale School of Medicine interviewed female heart attack survivors aged 55 and younger while the women were still in the hospital, and 9 out of 10 of them reported experiencing severe chest pain during the event. But only 4 out of 10 perceived the problem as heart-related. And this is an age group that the researchers have said assume that they are not at risk for heart disease and so don't consider their chest pain to be heart disease-related. And this is something that is kind of interesting because we talk a lot about looking for the odd symptoms and the other things out there, but we still need to remember that chest pain is the primary symptom of heart attack, of angina, and of the other symptoms of heart disease. Chest pain is really the thing we need to be looking for. And we need to educate our public. And this comes back to EMS Week again. We need to get out to our public and talk to them, educate them about what we do, and leave a little message for them to recognize signs and symptoms of a heart attack, signs and symptoms of a stroke. Remember, time is muscle, time is brain. And we can save people. We can get full recoveries if we can get these people to definitive care quickly. And part of the way we do that is to make sure the patient actually recognizes what's going on quickly and calls 911, activates the emergency response system rapidly so that we can get care to them quickly in the field and get them transported to definitive care centers as rapidly as possible. So this just highlights another need for us to be educating better in the community on our end, as well as on the end of the doctors and the hospitals and other health outreach sources that are out there. Okay, so it's the end of May, and it's a time for a lot of us to either have finished up school, thank goodness, or to be finishing up school, and maybe for some of us to be moving into testing for our national boards, for our local protocol tests, whatever. And if you're doing so, there's a lot of different ways that we study, a lot of different ways that we try to test our knowledge level and see if we need to study more in any given area. Well, a paramedic in Canada has come up with a great idea where she has actually invented a game. And the way she came up with the idea was she was really one of those people who just makes flashcards for everything. It was the way she studied while she was working through all the levels that she went through, emergency responder, EMT, and then eventually paramedic. And she kept all the flashcards. She just kept adding on to the package as she was building it. And when she got finished, she had this huge pile of flashcards that she had created, questions that she asked herself and used to quiz herself, and the answers. And what she decided to do was really just a natural, really outflow when you think about it. She turned around and created a board game that can be a great asset for teaching and training new EMS personnel in the field. There are different levels on the game. There are different things and topics like basic medical knowledge and medications and disease processes and things like that, all of which are available to test with. And there are levels here that are open to anybody with general medical knowledge. So you could open this up to people that are in nursing school. You could open it up to people that are maybe in dental school or training for any kind of medical field. There's just a ton of information. Great little article, and it's really interesting. The site that you can find this is emsedutainment.com. There'll be a link in the show notes, and it's the EMS Challenge game. So if you Google EMS Challenge, it'll be the first link that comes up. At least it was the first link for me, and it's a great idea and really a great way to study and have fun along the way. So whether you're an instructor or a student, and this is not a paid advertisement, but this is a great idea. And I know there's instructors out there who spend a lot of time making games to help people study and to help make class time go better. This might be a great way to pass some time when you got a study session with students or with your fellow classmates. So check it out. Finally, I'll end up with a topic that might be near and dear to my buddy Rick Rosati's heart, but it should be near and dear to all our hearts, and that's disaster preparedness. Are you prepared for a disaster? Do you have spare water put away? Do you have extra food at your home, extra medications that might be vital just in case disaster strikes? Well, you probably don't, and you're not alone, because most of the public out there doesn't either. Many Americans haven't taken basic steps to prepare for natural disasters. But the funny thing is, in a recent study and poll, they found that while the people were not prepared for disastrous storms like the hurricanes that struck a few years ago, strangely enough, they have even less faith that the federal government is prepared. And we've talked about this before, that the federal government, again, this year, 2 years after the hurricanes that passed through the Gulf Coast devastated things so badly down there, 2 years later, still came back to the federal government. FEMA came back with a report that said, nope, we're still not ready. We still don't really have a good disaster plan in place to meet such an unprecedented disaster again, which I've talked about before. Don't get me started. I have no patience with that kind of crap. You know, that's because some bureaucrat and sits in a room somewhere and fights over whether something should be included in the report or not, something should be included in the plan or not, rather than going out and getting somebody who actually knows what needs to be done into the panel, having them come up with a plan and putting it in place. You know, plans are only as good as the first time an incident strikes them. I don't care how careful you are and how many different pages you put into the plan and how many contingencies you have, the plan is going to fall apart within the first 24 hours no matter what. The extent to which it falls apart is based on the flexibility built into the plan, and there is no excuse for taking 2 years to build that kind of strong flexibility into any kind of disaster response plan. Trust me, we do it all the time. You know, we plan for dealing with disasters in the back of our ambulance. We plan for what we're going to do when we have rapidly deteriorating cardiac or respiratory patients. We have contingency plans. We have protocols that are in place. It does not take 2 years to develop a contingency plan, or at least a way to build a contingency plan on the fly. And that's why I don't blame these people that have been polled in Florida and the Gulf Coast about their own personal preparedness when they say that they don't think the federal government's any more prepared than they are. But I do think that if they feel that way, they darn well better get their butts out to Walmart and to the Sunny Surplus stores and whatever else it is they have out there to get themselves prepared, to have extra water in their homes, to make sure they have survival food, to make sure that they have the shelter that they might need to survive for a week or so without any support until the federal government gets their butts in gear and is actually able to get down to them. All right, enough said. I'm going to get off my soapbox. And that's going to wrap up tonight's news. Well, for tonight's tip and trick of the week and combined med of the week, I've got a treat for you. I've got an interview that I did with a pediatric anesthesiologist who is going to talk tonight about pediatric airway, a little bit about pediatric intubation, pediatric ET tube sizing, and just some other things about pediatric airway management in general. One thing he did want to say was to make sure that you all check with your own medical directors and your own protocols, that this is really just general information on pediatric airway that you really need to check with your own sources of information and training on this and rely on that, but that he was more than happy to share some information with me directly and in the hopes that it would help you become better providers for airway management in the field. So this is some great information, and I really appreciate that Will was able to talk with us and share this information, and hopefully we'll be able to have him on the show again in the future to talk about this topic again, because it's something that we just don't get enough time on. You know, thankfully, kids are, you know, I always say kids bounce, you know, they really don't need us that often. But when they do, they crash hard, and we really need to be prepared to aggressively manage airway ventilations and shock maintenance, basically. So I appreciate Will spending his time. And without further ado, I'm going to jump right on into the interview. Just a quick aside, this interview was conducted over cell phone. I was recording it on Skype here at home, but he was in the middle of a really bad thunderstorm and driving rain. So I've edited as best I can, and I think it's going to be suitable, but I wanted to let you know that the sound quality is a little rough on his end, and he apologized, but it was just the best way we could catch up with each other because of our busy schedules. Dr. Will, a lot of problems that we run into when dealing with pediatric patients is, first of all, we don't see serious pediatric airway complications that often in the field. And so when we do come upon a pediatric patient that requires advanced airway management, it really becomes a gut check moment for paramedics in the field. And one of the things that we run into quite frequently is endotracheal tube sizing. Is there a way to quickly size a child for an ET tube without getting out a Braslow tape or something like it?
Good question, Jamie, and I'm going to answer that two ways. I'll answer it a quick way, and then I'll answer it a quicker way. If you take, I'm going to assume that we're not going to be dealing with the premature infant in the field, so we're just going to talk about children in general between the ages of term birth and, you know, up to 18. But the best, one of the quick ways to do it is if you think of a term baby as a 3-5 tube and a 6-year-old as a 6 tube, then you've really kind of narrowed it down, because anybody over the age of 6 can use a 6 cuffed and up, and that takes care of you all the way to the teen years. So now you've got your newborn at a 3-5, and a 6-month is a 4-0. So now you've limited. All you have left is a 4-5, a 5, and a 5-5, and that kind of spans the gamut of your kids between the ages of about 18 months up to about 5 years of age. So that's the quick way, and I know it's very complicated, but the quicker way is easier, and old fogies like me, we had the look at the kid's pinky. You can look at the kid's pinky finger, okay, the fifth digit, and that's just about the same size as their trachea, plus or minus a half size. So, and that obviously is your typical child, not the child who, you know, is morbidly obese, which is actually a problem nowadays, but your typical run-of-the-mill kid you find pinky size, and that's tube size.
Great. That's a great tip. And it's something we've heard, but you know, it's one of those old paramedics tales, but it's good to hear from somebody who is much more experienced in the field that is something we can use as a rapid way to size a tube. We have the recent American Heart Association shift, and one of the new guidelines is pointing to that there's going to be a change, or is ongoing, a change towards moving back to a cuffed tube for pediatric patients. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think that's going to affect our sizing?
The cuffed tube is actually, it's a discussion point amongst physicians and professionals as well. One of the things that you need to take into consideration, and obviously as an EMT, a paramedic, you have certain guidelines that you'll be required to follow. And you'll have to follow those guidelines because that'll be the standard of care in your area, wherever that may be.
That's absolutely right.
But when you take a look at the actual size of a child's airway and the size of our airway as adults, give it a quick description. It'd be a garden hose in the adult, and it would be a coffee straw in the kid. And that is, anything that's going to decrease the cross-sectional diameter of that in the adult is going to be a deal, but in a child, it's going to be a really big deal. Why do I bring that up? If you put a cuffed tube, even a high volume, low pressure, which is what endotracheal tube cuffs are, even if you put that in a child's airway and leave it for a period of time, upon extubation, when that is planned and ready, you're going to have swelling of the airway, and that cuff, you know, can cause that swelling to be an issue. So that's something you have to take into consideration. And again, there are specific situations where a cuffed tube is mandated. I won't go into these because that's not getting to the distinction at this point. The other thing that you need to take into consideration is when you look on the side of the package of the endotracheal tube, in big blue letters next to the word Mallinckrodt or whatever it is, it'll say 6.0. That's the internal diameter of the tube. So that means that the thickness of the tube is going to add to an outer diameter, which, if I recall correctly, in an uncuffed tube is somewhere around 8.2 or 8.4. I don't remember exactly. But the cuff is going to increase that external diameter. By doing that, you're going to increase the size of the tube going through the cords and then parking itself in the trachea, which could then therefore increase the pressure on the inside of the trachea, edema, and then stridor upon extubation. But again, these are just thoughts that you want to, you know, put in the back of your head when you're making a tube decision.
Okay, that's good advice there. And I wasn't quite sure that it was going to increase the diameter that much, but I know we hear about pediatric airway that it really is not similar in physiology or in anatomy to the adult airway, that it really is different in shape and structure. And so that would make sense that we need to be paying more attention to the long-term outcome of our patients.
Right. In the pediatric, and I'll digress for a second, but then I'll let you get back on track. The adult airway is completely parallel. The size of the diameter of the ring just inferior to the larynx and the last ring prior to the bifurcation of the carina, they're just about the same diameter. The narrowest part of an adult airway is the cord. That's why you put a cuff tube through the cord, you inflate the cuff, and therefore you form somewhat of a seal. Well, in the child's airway, particularly the younger children, it's more of a funnel. So the narrowest part of the child's airway is not actually the cords at all. It's the subglottic space. And it's actually down about maybe a centimeter to 15 millimeters inferior to the cords. That's where your narrowest part of the airway is. So that's one of the reasons why cup tubes are less applicable in children, particularly when you're doing, in my case, you know, procedures in the operating room.
Okay, that's good to know. So when we're dealing with pediatric airway management in the field, there's a strong push for us to really work within our basic life support procedures. In other words, using a bag valve mask up to a point. And it's always been a discussion, you know, when do you know that it's right when a child is in respiratory distress, when is it appropriate to move from the bag valve mask to the ETT tube? And I know there's no hard and fast answer to that, but, you know, as a gut check, what do we look for? What kind of things are we looking for to make that decision?
Bottom line in ventilating a child, ventilating anybody, but ventilating a child is to exchange gases. If you're exchanging gases, you're ventilating a child. If you fail to achieve gas exchange with a bag valve mask, you need to either move to the next step or let somebody else do it, because your bagging, as you call it, your ventilation is insufficient. So if I had to give you a good answer to that question, if you are not exchanging gases, if you are not getting chest rise, if you're not getting bilateral auscultation positive, if you're not getting a positive CO2 change on your indicator, then you need to obviously reposition the head, get a better seal. If you can't do it for whatever reason, you need to either let somebody else give it a try or go to an intracheal tube and secure your airway.
Okay, that's again, some good pointers there. Dr. Will, I'm always talking to people in my podcast about really working hard to get a good medical history, and especially in patients that may become critical because of key things that you might find out in the medical history that'll help you with treating a patient that is rapidly deteriorating. We see, especially in the coming up springtime with the pollen and the increased allergy response, we'll see more child asthmatics in our practice. At least that's been my experience. What kind of things can we ask with reference to children who are suffering an asthma attack that'll help us take a better history and be better prepared to know what to expect?
Good question. In my practice, obviously it's easier for me because I get a chance to evaluate these children, you know, the night before a procedure, the night before, in my case, an anesthetic. And if they do have asthma, then I can sit down and take an extra, you know, time with the parent and discuss with them what type of issues they've had with asthma, what their pediatrician does, do they see a pulmonology specialist, and we can spend an inordinate amount of time on that the day before. In the case of a child that you're going to see that's in distress, you don't have that luxury of being able to sit down and say, you know, mom or dad, what's going on? How are things going? Tell me about your child's history. A couple of quick things that I would suggest to get a good handle on how severe your child could get. A quick one is, when was the last time Bobby was in the ER for an attack? And that'll give you a real good idea. One, that they know and that they're a good historian. You may be dealing with an aunt who only takes care of a kid, you know, once in a while. And two, it'll give you an idea of how severe the asthma attacks have been. Well, I've only really had to take him to the pediatrician, and he gives him this puffer thing, and we come home. Okay, then here's a child who probably isn't going to get into severe distress. Versus, Bobby usually goes to the ER, you know, three times during the spring. Okay? And then you ask, well, has he ever been admitted before? We usually end up getting admitted each time. All right, well, then you have a child who is going to decompensate pretty rapidly if they're already in the middle of an asthma attack. So get ready for bad issues. The other thing that you can ask is, who smokes? Who doesn't smoke? When does Bobby get his attacks? Is it only when, you know, the pollen comes out? Is it only when leaves start to form on the tree? And again, that'll give you a good idea. That's quick questions that'll give you an idea of what kind of troubles you're going to end up with real shortly.
Okay, great. Another question dealing with asthmatic children is, we give them our albuterol treatments, our nebulizer treatments in the field, and we're getting them prepped and we're moving down the road. But sometimes when they don't respond to that, what are we looking for to see that they aren't responding? We're doing a full assessment. We're listening to breath sounds. We're auscultating. We're looking at them. What are some things we can look for to give us some indicators that it's time to move on to sub-Q epi or another next-line treatment?
If you have a patient who is currently intubated, you can obviously look at peak inspiratory pressures. You can look at end expiratory phases, again, depending upon how much monitoring you have available to you in the field. But if a person is not responding well to beta agonists, albuterol, metoprolol, whatever type of agonist you have with you, and you're not exchanging and your sats are low and the bag is as stiff as a baseball glove, well, then you need to think about going into, you know, some endotracheal tube epinephrine or even sub-Q, and then depending upon obviously your standard care and the plans that you have set up with your particular area and the hospital that you're serving, then that's one of the things that you'll need to head into.
Okay, that's good. Now, we're really starting to see more and more the use of capnography devices in the field. We've been using them for some time for verification of tube placement, looking just for the presence or the absence of gas exchange to verify that our tube is indeed in the lungs or in the trachea. But we're seeing more and more of a push and a discussion in the EMS field, both among advanced practice paramedics and their medical directors, looking at the use of capnography devices, such as the nasal prongs, to monitor patients that aren't intubated, but to monitor their status. And what I would just want to know is, do you see a plus for that? Do you see that that's something that could be more useful to us in the future, that's something we should be learning more about?
Yes and no, and I'll separate this into two answers. We'll look at quantitative and qualitative capnography. The adapters that you have in your kit that will change color in the presence of CO2, that's a qualitative measure. That'll just tell you yes or no whether or not your tube is detecting CO2. The qualitative measurement would be that where you would have constant gas monitoring. And if you've ever been in the OR, which here in where I practice in this area, EMTs, paramedics, respiratory therapists, they will rotate through the OR and they will get a chance to do some intubations, to see some monitoring of the patient, how we do it. So if that's standard in your listener's area, then they have seen the capnography, the constant capnography, which is the quantitative. And why I'm spending so much time on this is, if you look at it, it looks like a bunch of buildings in a row. So you'll have an inhalatory phase, which there will be no CO2 because you're pushing air in. And then you will have an exhalation phase where the CO2 will rise rapidly until it reaches the plateau, let's say 40. And then it'll be a squared off top, just like the top of a building. And then you'll ventilate the patient again and it'll go down. So you have these nice rectangles across your screen. If you have a person who is having a reactive airway disease event, status asthmaticus, bronchospasm, anything that's going to cause impeded flow, particularly we're talking about the expiratory or exhalation phase, what will happen is those little buildings, they'll start to turn into what we refer to as ramps or angles, or I don't want to use the word sawtooth because that gets into the flutter issue of EKGs, but it'll look like a ramp, okay, or a wedge, in which the exhalation phase, the CO2 that appears on your screen, will reach its maximum, it's 40, and we're using 40 as an arbitrary number, will reach its 40 in a longer period of time. So it'll take its time to get there, and what you end up with, little ramps or shark fins, And that can tell you, okay, I'm having an exhalation phase restriction issue. I'm having bronchospasm. I'm having, you know, some type of impeded exhalatory gas exchange.
Okay. And what we are using, at least in my area, and I know in several neighboring areas, are advanced cardiac monitors that have inline continuous capnography monitoring available with both waveform and a digital readout where we can actually see what the end-tidal CO2 reading is. And that's something I see it moving towards. So we can definitely use this to monitor patients with a respiratory, some kind of obstructive respiratory problem, and we would see the effect. If we were administering albuterol, we would see those buildings or those ramps return back to a more squared off structure.
Correct.
Well, Dr. Will, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with the MedicCast listeners. And I just want to thank you. I know it's raining where you are, cats and dogs, you said, so I'm going to let you go, but thanks again.
Jamie, thanks for having me on.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I'd like to thank Will again for taking the time to record that interview and get us the information that we so desperately need on pediatric airway management. So thanks again, Will, for that. As always, make sure that you check in at the website at medicast.com for up-to-date information, links to everything that I've talked about in this episode and this week's show notes, and also periodic articles that I come across. I put up about maybe 4 or 5 different posts during the week of other things that I find that I think might be of interest to you. So make sure you check out the MedicCast website at www.medicast.com. Also, make sure that you check in with me if you have any questions, any comments about this or any other episode or something I've put up on the website, or even corrections. You know, I'm not perfect and I'm going to make mistakes, and I rely on you guys to make sure that I can correct those mistakes so that we'd have the best information possible going out in the field. So you can reach me here at podmedic@mac.com. That's my email address. You can also call in directly to the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And you can leave a message there on the voicemail line. Please make sure you leave your email address at the end of the message, because that way I can get back to you if I need clarification or have anything that I want to just respond to you directly on. I will clip it out if I include your voicemail in the show so that you don't give your email address out to everybody. But it's a good way for me to get back in touch with you if I wanted a little clarification about something. If you'd like to get on the email newsletter list, you can go over to the website and click the link in the upper right-hand corner for the newsletter. It's absolutely free, and I do not spam or sell that information to anybody else. It's strictly a way for me to get you links from the show notes to let you know when the new episodes come out, as well as other information maybe once or twice a month that I think might be important for you to find out about, like upcoming episodes of the MedicCast Live, so that you can actually call in and interact with myself and the guests that I have on the show. So you can sign up for the MedicCast newsletter, and in addition to getting just the newsletter, show notes, and everything else that I send out, each newsletter actually has its own little separate tip and trick that can help you with a little something along the way. It's not a major tip, but it's always a little something that I use or I found somebody else using that can help you provide better care in the field. And you can get that as a MedicCast newsletter subscriber. Well, I think that's enough of me talking. I think we'll wrap up as we always do with some excellent PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network. And I had a great tune this week that I came upon called Smile Again by an artist by the name of Carrie Cunningham. And this song really touches me. It's something about, you know, the people that we forget about that are our prime supporters. And that's the people that we have at home. You know, we have those rough calls every now and then, and we need somebody to kind of lift us up. And it might be your parents, it might be a brother or sister, it might be your wife, your husband, your girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. Somebody that helps get a smile on your face when you're having a bad day or had one of those rough calls. And we don't appreciate those people enough. And so in EMS week this week, while everyone else is appreciating us, We need to make sure that we appreciate our support networks. And Carrie wrote a great song that just kind of reminds me of that on my home front. So I wanted to go ahead and leave you with that. Carrie was kind enough to call in a little intro for her song and a little thank you to the rest of us. So before she comes on here and introduces her music, I want to go ahead and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, remember, scene safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Carrie Cunningham, and I just want to say thank you to every EMT for putting in long, hard hours and sleepless nights. Your service plays a vital part in all our lives, and you are all loved very much. Have a great week.
I will break down these walls that are surrounding you. I will shelter you from the rain. I will comfort you when you're feeling low. Just to see you smile.